Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast. Now, on today's show, I've got Christian Brehm. Christian is an enigma. I'll just leave it at that. He is, he's also a fellow podcaster. He runs a business that focuses on helping creatives kind of get unstuck. And he does it from a profit first perspective. So we know a lot of the profit first people we've interviewed over the years. He does it a little bit different. I think you'll enjoy it. So stay tuned. We will be right back on in just one second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Christian, how you doing, my friend?
I'm well, Jeff. Thank you for having me on.
I am so glad to have you on. I'm looking forward to the conversation today. Why don't you kick us off? Tell us a little bit about how you got started and got to where you're at today. I was born a poor black
guy. That is exactly the line that I was thinking, but I'm like, I can't lead with that because I don't know what Jeff would say with that. I was not born a poor black child. I have lived all my life in Oklahoma, born and raised here.
We're sorry for you.
Yes, but that's okay. I know some people might find that a negative, but it is the home to the world champion NBA Oklahoma City Thunder. So
that is true.
There you go. I worked a couple of places as a financial professional, CPA. Worked for one of the big three, worked for one of my clients as a commercial lender, and just had the intuition that I was not going to achieve what I wanted to do in life working for someone else. But at the ripe age of 26, I had some prescience that if I waited longer, it was going to be harder for me to make that decision. Now, that was probably just a rationalization. Because I had two young children, my wife worked very part-time, and I quit my banking job, got an SBA loan, and bought an accounting franchise, went to Southern California for franchise training for 3 weeks, put all that on a credit card, and came back and, really had no option but to succeed. Yeah. And I tried to recreate in my brain, like, what the hell was I thinking? and I can't really get there. I don't really know what I was thinking.
The 27-year-old brain's different as you get older.
100%. But I did understand. I really didn't have anything to lose. I mean, they can't take my family away from me. And I didn't have
anything. Worst case scenario, you're still a CPA regardless.
So. Yeah. I mean, I knew I was employable.
Yeah.
But I really wasn't. So I bought the franchise, started and grew it until I really burnt out and walked away from the business for 2 years. My brother was my partner, and I left him in charge. I went and started a software company because that's what every rational person does.
But he does, right?
And, you know, the software company was not a success, but it wasn't a complete failure. It was just enough to keep me engaged. But, you know, the accounting firm did not do well under my brother, and I had to step back in. But I did it very reluctantly. I remember specifically telling my brother, I don't know how this software thing is going to work out, but I can tell you if it doesn't work out, I'm not coming back and running an accounting firm. I'm not doing it. But 2 years later, that's where I was. And I told him, and we had one other partner at the time, I said, we're going to have to do this differently because I can't do it the way we did it before.
Yep.
And it was at that point that we implemented the entrepreneurial operating system. We had attempted it before and failed. This time we hired a third party implementer to come in and nice. Help us implement it. And that was about 8 years ago.
Okay.
And since
still
then,
relatively recent. Yeah.
Yeah. Since then, everything in the business has changed. I've changed. And through that process of implementing EOS, I realized that, you know, I was burnt out, but I was burnt out because I was at my limit with the company. The company was, had been capped by me.
Yeah.
And I did not see that. And once I realized that I was the problem, I had to go to work on that. And to some extent, especially if you ask my leadership team, I'm still working on that because you reach that inflection point where you have to decide, is it worth it? Because I could have continued doing it, or I could have sold it, or but the amount of effort that I had to put in to change myself and change the company so that we could go further was harder than starting. Like, you know, and so I understand where people get to that plateau and they're like, I'm fine right where I am. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not willing to put in that extra effort to go to that next level.
Yeah.
And
cause it's work.
Yeah. I mean, for some people, and they're totally happy with, okay, I'm making a good living. You know, the problem that they end up with is they don't grow anymore. And then they decide, hey, I want to sell this business and realize it's worth nothing at that point because it's so, you know, organized around you.
Yes. And you know, I had reached, the business had reached the point where it was not dependent upon me, clearly, because I stepped away from it for 2 years. But the process to take it to the next level required me to fundamentally change. And it's this you know, strange situation that people run into is they have success, but what got them from point A to point B will not take them to point C. And so it's like, I've got to learn a whole new set of skills in order to go from B to C. And it's like, I'm fine staying right here where I am. And most people do. I mean, and that's totally fine.
Yeah.
I'm sick.
Yeah.
I need help.
Yeah. I need help. I need to do it. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about, you know, so you were more of a traditional tax practice type firm, you know, prior. How did you start to, you know, I'm assuming after you started getting involved in EOS, that kind of adjusted your work when it came to your clients, correct?
Yeah. So we didn't initially when we implemented EOS. I mean, part of EOS is defining a target market and the go-to-market strategy. And I thought we had that defined for, you know, 4 years. But what I realized was it was still too broad. Okay. And I find that a recurring problem with entrepreneurs is that they set their target market way too broadly. And I think it's motivated by fear primarily because there's this idea that I don't want to say no to anybody. Yeah. Like, you know, if I narrow it down too much,
I remember those hungry years at the beginning.
Right.
I don't want to go back.
Right. And it, there's this idea that if I say no to people, I'm going to grow slower, but it's the exact opposite. If you say no to the right people and yes to the right people, you actually grow faster, but it's counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you kind of navigate or you narrowed yourself down to creatives. Explain to me a little bit about that.
Well, Jeff, we went through this very high level MBA type analysis where we asked two questions of the team. Who do we like working for, mm-hmm. and who values what we do?
There you go.
That was it. Yeah. It wasn't like we think this is going to be the growth potential. It's mm-hmm. not. This is not where we think we have a strategic advantage. None of that. It was just who do we like working with, and who likes working with us. Mm-hmm. And we put that list together, and over half of them were in creative industries.
Nice.
And it was not the majority of our clients by any stretch.
Okay.
It was just yeah. that who made that list. And so we said, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to lean into this. But as we did that, and we really started trying to not just change the marketing, but change the service, like tailoring the deliverable, tailoring our solution to the specific needs of the target, did we really start to see traction? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you take the average business under $10 million in revenue, 80% of finances and accounting is the same. From
yeah.
I don't care if you own a pet grooming shop or a construction company, 80% mm-hmm. of it is the same. Now sure. there is 20% that is
unique to that unique, industry or
right?
whatever. Yeah.
But to me, it was, that's really not even the question. It's, are you solving the problem the client has or the customer has in terms that they define it? Hmm. And that's a huge distinction. So most small businesses lead with their features and benefits. This is what we do. This is the value we deliver. As opposed to saying, I know what your problem is. This is your problem. And here is my solution in terms that you describe your problem.
Yeah.
Because it shifts the focus from you internally to, mm-hmm. to the client. And that yeah. changes everything. It changes your marketing. It changes your delivery. It changes the way you do things internally. Mm-hmm. But for existing businesses, that's kind of hard because you kind of get stuck in the rut of what you do, right?
Yeah.
But the reality is, I don't even really care what you do. It's not just accountants or professional services. People aren't buying what you think that they're buying.
Yeah.
We had this conversation internally, and you can imagine having this conversation with a bunch of accountants, and I'm like, dude, they don't buy bookkeeping and accounting and taxes or wealth management. They don't buy any of that. What they buy is a feeling around money.
Yeah.
And my team's just looking at me like, huh. And then the reality becomes, well, I can't affect how you feel, Jeff, right? Like I can't do anything about how you feel about anything.
Yeah.
But what I can control is the processes and the systems that I give you. And mm-hmm. I use this probably very poor analogy. Is that like if your spouse is unhappy and they come home, right? Like I can't do anything about what happened outside the house and at work or whatever. But what mm-hmm. I can do is I can make you dinner and I can rub mm-hmm. your feet and yep. I can use kind words. Right. So once we made that shift, like, okay, I can do everything right as an accountant. I can check all the boxes and make all sure all the numbers all add up, but that doesn't do anything about Jeff's feelings. That doesn't yeah. do a damn thing. Right.
Yeah.
So that's how
which a lot of accountants go down that road. I mean, they have that, you know, okay, it's all done and all that. Yeah. But I still don't feel in control.
Right. And then, they wonder why the client's unhappy. Like, why? Yeah. I don't get it. It's all right. But yeah. But this mm-hmm. isn't about right or wrong. It's yeah. about how they feel.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's about, yeah, well, it's just, I mean, so many times, I mean, and I've worked with multiple accountants over the years and bookkeepers, and, you know, it what they don't understand a lot of times is the simple fact that I want to feel, everything in my life feels like it's out of control when it comes to money, and mm-hmm. I want to feel in control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's as a wealth manager, as a tax person, as a, you know, bookkeeper, that's what I try and make my clients. But, you know, we don't even talk about the numbers half the time. We talk about, all right, where are we going? You know, what's our goal? What do you, you know, let's get you on track with where you want to be. And here's the logical path that we're going to follow. And, you know, from there, they don't even worry anymore. You know, most of my clients, correct, unless the market goes crazy, and then they come to me and go, hey, is everything okay? Well, no, it's totally fine. And, you know, I can show you the numbers, but we're good.
Right. And on the flip side of that is that, like, I can't make you change your behavior. If you're going to make stupid decisions as a business owner or as an investor or whatever, like, I can't fix that. Right. And I can't control it. So I'm not even going to try. So part of the process in building that business is setting that expectation up front and screening. Like, you know, if you're not going to listen to us, then I can't help you.
Yeah.
And I don't want you because you're just going to cause trouble.
Yeah, you're a pain in my butt.
Exactly.
At that point. So let's talk a little bit about your process when, let's say I come to you, I'm a creative business owner. How are we going to approach this? Do you approach it from the tax side, or do you approach it more from a, kind of a consultant approach?
Much more consultative. You know, you mentioned it's really about defining the goals for the business and therefore the financial goals.
Yeah.
And it's about setting those expectations. So, like, if I come in and my business is a dumpster fire, I'm not making money. I don't really care what your tax situation is, because you're not paying taxes if you're not making money.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter what kind of records you've got, because again, your business isn't going to be around. So, we focus a lot more initially around getting clarity. And a lot of times it's creating that clarity for the client of, like, okay, what are you trying to accomplish with this business? What are your goals? And then we can work around those things. Yeah, we can bring processes to the table and do all those things. And we certainly do, but that's to me secondary. It's really understanding what you want out of your business and helping you clarify that, and then coming alongside you to guide you to get there.
Makes sense. So, all right. We have that conversation. We talked right at the beginning of the show that, or before the show started, that you kind of work in a almost like a 90-day process with a lot of clients. You're trying to move them through a process initially.
Well, when I was speaking about that, I was speaking about what work I do personally outside of CORE. In CORE, there is usually a 90-day onboarding process where, you know, we are clarifying and setting those expectations and getting you into our processes. It's interesting. If you look at our retention for new clients, the first 12 months that they're with us, it is about, the percentage that drop as clients, it's twice as much in the first 10 years, the first year, 12 months, than it is for the rest of the lifetime of the client.
Yeah.
And so we focus real hard on that first year client experience, really. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, there are variables we can't control. Sure. And it's just, you know, part of the model that's baked in, that some people are going to come with unrealistic expectations. Some people aren't going to do the work they need to do. They're not going to do what we need them to do for us to do what we need to do. So, you know, that's what happens. But, I know from the data that we are solving the problem for the vast majority of the people that we bring on. I went to this mastermind of, marketing agencies earlier this year. I got invited, and there are about 20 of them sitting around, all of them seven-figure. Well, I don't want to say that. A lot of them were seven-figure, but these were larger agencies.
Sure.
And they were talking about their retention, I don't remember the exact, but it essentially was that they had about 50% turnover a year,
which makes sense.
And they were fine with that because it was better than the industry average. Right. And I'm sitting here scratching my head. I'd had agency owners as clients, but I'd never really dived into it at that level. But I'm sitting here thinking to myself, like, if we had half of our clients leave every year, mm-hmm. I'd be like, we're not doing something right.
Yeah,
like,
what's broken?
Right. We're not solving the problem, right? Yeah.
That's funny. What are you, is there any projects you're working on that you're going to, that you can share with us?
Well, I am rebranding and relaunching my website as we talked okay. about doing. I am taking up the moniker of the Profit Profit.
Nice.
And I already checked the trademark and it's available.
And it's good.
Yeah, we're good. And I'll be honest why I'm doing it. I've done fractional CFO work in the past to kind of scratch my entrepreneurial itch, and I've done some coaching. But the reality is I've gotten to the point in my business where my presence causes more harm than good. Right. And I have to, I'm one of those people that can't ignore things. Like, mm-hmm. you know, if I see something, I got to say something. And a lot of times, even though I fully delegated responsibility and authority to people, the fact that I even mention something causes something. It's like, well, is that something that I need to be working on? Is that important? Is that right? Am I right? And so I told my team, I mean, I kind of had this existential crisis about 30 days ago where I'm like, I've got to get the hell out of here. I got to go do something else. Or
I gotta go fix other people's problems.
Exactly.
I can't fix mine.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's what I'm working on. I'm also finishing my short story. It may turn into a novel. Originally I wanted to do a screenplay, but I figured that's actually really hard to write screenplays.
Yeah.
And I have no experience with it. And then I started writing a novel and I'm like, God, that's a slog too. So then I came back to a short story. But now that I've kind of got the short story done, I'm like, well, I can go ahead and make this
expand it to a novella.
Yeah.
People don't want to read long stuff anymore. But if you do novellas, I mean, I've sold three of those. People, they eat them up because it's, you know, it might be a weekend read at that point. And there's lots of them that they want. Yeah.
And I love the story, and it's a story that I think needs to be told. So it's loosely historical fiction. I mean, the individuals are not historical characters. Mm-hmm. There are historical characters in the story, but it's essentially a love story, but it takes place in one of the darkest eras of American history. The forced relocation of the Choctaw Nation from Mississippi. To Oklahoma. And so that's why I'm Choctaw. My wife's Choctaw. What started it? It's kind of interesting. So I was talking to a movie producer, one of our clients. And I said, you know, I think this would be an interesting story. So when 12 years ago, I got asked to be an expert witness in a case in tribal court in Mississippi.
Okay.
And I'm like, I've lived all my life in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, a recognized member of the tribe. Yeah. Don't really.
Every other Choctaw you've ever met.
Right.
Pretty much came from Oklahoma.
Right. Yeah. Never really. It's not like I'm involved in politics. I don't even vote for tribal elections. But I had no idea there was still a tribe in Mississippi.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Oh,
they have
cool.
their own court. You know, I'm like, and I go there and I'm like, huh. And so in the back of my mind, I had this narrative that there was this group of Mississippi people, Mississippi Choctaw, that kind of held out on the federal relocation. Like they fought, you know, they were rebels and they hid in the hills. And so I was talking to this producer. I said, this would be an interesting story to tell. He goes, yeah, that does sound kind of interesting. Like, what, you know, I wonder what that story was. Well, once I started doing the research, I'm like, oh, well, they weren't really rebels, but it's still an interesting story.
They just got kind of forgotten and left behind.
Well, so what happened historically is when the working title is Dancing Rabbit, and the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit was the treaty that sealed the deal to move the Choctaw out. And it's interesting all that was negotiated over 400 years between the British, the French, and the Americans with the Choctaw. But that was the one that was like, okay, you got to move. We're going to trade land for Mississippi, for Oklahoma. And part of that treaty was if the Choctaw wanted to stay, they had a homestead in Mississippi. They could keep it. And they got, I don't know how many acres. It was like 60, 80, I don't know. But all you had to do was sign up and you could keep your land. The trade-off was you had to become a citizen of the United States. You had to become a citizen of Mississippi. So you lose your tribal sovereignty. Okay. Well, so the majority of people left, right?
Okay.
However, there were some that stayed. But the problem was that they put this racist general in charge of executing the treaty, and he literally would make all kinds of excuses for not even showing up so that they could sign. And they had like a year to sign up, right? And so very few people actually got to sign up to keep their land.
Sure.
And that was the residual. That's what was left in Mississippi.
It's just, I always think of the movie Maverick with Graham Greene in there.
Yes.
When he's the Indian chief in there. And it was so funny. You know what? We're moving into a swamp next time, because every time we stop someplace, somebody comes in and takes away our land. So we're just moving into a disgusting swamp the next time.
Yeah. And what was interesting about that is they got some of the best land in Oklahoma from
I think the trade-off over Mississippi, they got a better deal in the end.
And that's part of the compelling reason behind this story is that and I'm not making any justification for what Jackson and the federal government did, but it is a story of perseverance in that they did make a better life for themselves in Oklahoma than they would have had in Mississippi. And they got some most beautiful land in the country. I don't know if you've ever been to Southeast Oklahoma, but it's gorgeous.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Gorgeous land.
Beautiful.
Tons of water. Not a lot of it is arable. It wasn't really great agriculturally, but definitely hunting. But the thing there that I wanted to say is that the story that I want to tell is, you know, what is home? Home is the people that you live with and love. And that's why it had to be a love story.
But not the location you're in.
No, it isn't. Yeah. And I think that story's been told throughout human history. Like, you know, the Choctaw were not the first or the last to be relocated. You know, I think it's going to have some resonance that
I think it'd be an interesting story to tell, because I don't think a lot of people even know that story at all.
No,
I mean, honestly, you didn't even know the story.
I didn't. And you know, I think as a whole, the forced relocation of natives is a black hole in American history, in the sense that it's just not discussed at all.
Nope.
Absolutely, you know, there's a whole bunch of history and discussion around slavery and civil rights, rightly so. But what the federal government did to the native tribes was
over
ugly.
Over and over. Yeah. I mean, yes, the forced loot, but I mean, even just the simple breaking of treaties. Okay. We've made a treaty. You can have this. Everything's good. Wait a minute. We want that land. You know, or, oh, there's something we want there, and just whoosh. right, and, you know, swoop right in. And
the interesting part about the history to me was like how long it had been going on between the European man and the native man. There were centuries where they lived and cohabitated fairly well.
Yep.
But the fact that there was this point where they could not live together was inevitable. Mm-hmm. Because there were two different cultures, and one culture had much, much better technology.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, the Mississippi people wanted that land and they could force it. And that's why the Choctaw left. They're like, well, we're not going to die over it.
Yeah.
And you know, to your point about the breaking of treaties, I find what's so interesting is right like 30 years before that Treaty of Dancing Rabbit was signed, the Choctaw were over fighting with the feds against the Creek Nation. Mm-hmm. And the Choctaw and Creek did not get along. And so they were like, fine, we'll go beat them up for you. But you know, that's also what led to the sense of betrayal is like, man, we were just helping you guys out.
We fought with you guys and now you're screwing us. And
right.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, I hope you do write it. I mean, I've been on that path of the fiction books for a while, so it's fun. I might
make you a beta reader then.
Absolutely, I'd love to read it.
Okay.
Yeah, I've written multitudes of you know, I ended up having to write them under different, you know, pen names because I'm like, okay, it was confusing the hell out of people because I write all this stuff about finance and
I hadn't thought about that, but I may have to take
yeah, it's just if you do a lot of writing, it just kind of messes with people's brains if you that's start true. Talking about
I hadn't
it,
thought
you
know, about
either
that.
Way. Okay, fantastic. So let's change gears. Talk about the fast five questions real quick.
Okay. Sure.
All right. First question. Wake up in the morning. Business is gone. You have $500 in your pocket, a laptop computer, place to live, food and clothing. What do you do first?
I think it would be doing what I'm, you know, starting to redoing, which is go and help business owners get stuck. So my niche is entrepreneurs that have success, but then they're stuck at that level. So this isn't working with startups or people trying to find their footing. It's like, okay, I've had success, but whatever I'm doing now is not working anymore.
Yeah.
And that's what I would do.
Okay. Perfect. I love that. Second one, what's your biggest business mistake you've ever made? Pick one.
I mean, functionally, it is getting in my own way. Practically, it was I had salespeople and marketing people work for me over the years, but with this EOS iteration and doing the target market, I was taking that role by default. Because no one else wanted it in the organization, and I seemed to be the one to do it best. But the realization that I was not the right person in that seat, and I hung on too long to that seat. You know, I'm a big fan of the book Who Not How, because it's. You know, you got to get the right people in the right seats in the organization and then they'll figure it out. But the reality was I was not the right person. And I had a chorus of other people saying, well, yeah, you're the right person because they weren't the right person.
Yeah, because I don't want to do it.
So. Right. But I should have said, you know what, I use the analogy of like, I didn't get rope burns. I held on to that rope until it cut down to the bone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is stupid. Why am I continuing to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you realized it and now you move on to another.
I'm a slow learner.
Oh, I know. I'm hard headed. So I just tend to keep going until I get beat up too much. But all right, what's a good book that you'd recommend for our audience?
You mean besides the Bible?
Besides the Bible.
Okay. Yes. I think I can speak to some of the books that have influenced me as an entrepreneur. The E-Myth, Scaling Up by Vern Harnish, Traction by Gina Wickman. Some interesting books that I've found influential are Confessions of a Pricing Man.
I've not heard of that
on one. Pricing and marketing. Yeah, okay. Very interesting. It's kind of a scholarly book, lots of data, but the data is fascinating. This guy, I can't remember the name off the top of his head, but he basically in the 70s created the pricing consulting industry.
Interesting.
So that one's good. Alchemy by Rory Sutherland. Okay. He's a partner with Ogilvy, largest advertising agency in the world. That book is fascinating. Greatness Cannot Be Planned. Another great book. I read a lot. These are just the ones that just filter the top of my head.
Awesome. What's a tool that you use in your business that you might recommend?
I've tried a lot of AI tools. I was an early adopter of chat.
Yep.
And I've really struggled with finding use cases for this stuff to actually be worth the time.
Okay.
However, I have also started relearning how to code. You know how I started a software company?
Yeah.
I've gone back and I'm doing online courses on development, software development. Not to become a code monkey, but to be like, I have no intention of doing this coding development myself,
but you need to understand how
I want to know enough to work with the people that do and understand the capacities, right?
Sure.
Like what, and that's the scary thing about these AI. I mean, they're not AI, these large language models, that the they're black boxes. No one understands how they work. And that was the case before algorithms, neural nets, all of these things that have been around for a decade, they don't know how they work. They just work. And so you have to understand, you're never going to understand the box, but how can you manipulate the box to get what you want?
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I've literally spent 2.5 years building, I talk about it all the time. I mean, I've written books utilizing AI and you cannot tell. I've put these in front of people and said, this one book was written by AI. One was written by me. Tell me which one was it. And nobody can tell the difference because I've trained it to literally write me.
Yes.
And I go from, a project that would have taken a week to a project that takes 3 days.
Yes. Know? And that is the thing that it has done is it has made much cheaper and much quicker technology that, like when I did my software company, what I spent $100,000 propping up with developers over the course of a year, you could produce for $10,000 in a month.
Yeah.
Now, right? So that is what's changed. But you still have to understand what you're building.
You got to understand where you're going.
Exactly.
It doesn't know where you want to go. You've got to guide it and you need to understand that process.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. You know, I worry about with kids in school. I mean, I do believe they need to be taught to utilize AI, but they need to understand that you need to still understand how it works. You need to understand what the actual process is. You know,
I went, one of the very first LLM seminars I went to was put on by Perry Marshall and he had a speaker there that was a neural scientist, brain scientist. Okay. And he said that the cognitive ability, this is March, ChatGPT came out in October. Okay.
Got it.
He said the cognitive decline in America at that point, which wasn't influenced by LLMs, the aptitude test that the U.S. Army uses for incoming recruits of enlisted men, when they did it in World War II, people were average coming into the Army with a 10th grade education.
Yep.
In the most recent data at that point, it was down to 8th grade level. And he said that the biggest problem, now we were there, this was probably including COVID era data. He said the problem is people don't read anymore.
Yeah.
And the way your brain processes data reading is fundamentally different than it is when you're listening or watching. And he drew a direct line between those two. And his recommendation was you need to read. You need to read stuff that you don't normally do. So like if you normally read fiction, read historical data or poetry.
Yep.
And then write about what you read. So that cognitive decline is reversible. But it's not going to be using LLMs. and it's not going to be from listening to podcasts or watching YouTube videos. You're going to have to read.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and write. And on top of that.
Yes, read and write.
All right, last question for you. What is your definition of freedom?
Oh, my initial answer is in Christ, but I don't know that that's what you were looking for. So I'll give you a different answer, a secular answer. I think freedom is knowing why you're doing what you're doing. You're not just doing it because everybody else thinks you need to be doing it, or that was the expectation that was put on you from your family or your upbringing. Like, you know why you're doing what you're doing. You make the money that you want to make to be able to do the things that you want to do. You know, time without money is not a lot of fun, and money without time is absolutely no fun. And all of that needs to be under the umbrella of, why are you here? Like, what is it that you're about?
Absolutely. Fantastic answer. I love it. Your first answer was right too. So, well, Christian, if somebody is interested in learning a little bit, especially with the new focus that you have, or about CORE, where's the best place to find information?
So my personal website is just christianbrim.com. It is being rebranded, and hopefully by the time you produce this and put it out, it will be already up. It's up now, but it's ugly. And CORE Group US is our website for CORE.
Beautiful. Thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it. It was a fantastic conversation. You said it was going to be at the beginning, and it came completely in line. So,
well, Jeff, thanks for having me, and thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Excellent. Well, folks, make sure that you join us here on the channel. Best way to do that is hit subscribe, whatever channel you're on, whether you're watching or listening.
Yes, subscribe.
We will see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.